By the summer of 58, Marion herself had become her husband's principal unhappiness. 5 years after the deaths of Thomas and Timothy, Marion believed she caused Ted more grief than their dead sons. Marion also feared that she might not always be able to keep herself from loving her daughter. "And if I let myself love Ruth," Marion thought, "what will I do if something happens to her?" Marion knew that she could not go through losing a child again. Ted had told Marion that he wanted to try separating for the summer, just to see if they might both be happier apart. For years, long before the deaths of her beloved boys, Marion had wondered if she should divorce Ted. Now he wanted to divorce her. If they'd divorced when Thomas and Timothy were alive, there could have been no question about which of them would have kept the children. They were her boys. They would have chosen her. Ted could never have contested such an obvious truth, but now Marion didn't know what to do. There were times when she couldn't bear even to talk to Ruth. Understandably, this child would want her father. "So is that the deal?" Marion wondered. "He takes all that's left, the house, which she loved but didn't want, and Ruth, whom she either couldn't or wouldn't allow herself to love. Marion would take her boys. Of Thomas and Timothy, Ted could keep what he could remember. I get to keep all the photographs," Marion decided. The sound of the ferry horn startled her. Her index finger, which had continued to trace the borders of Eddie O'Hare's bare shoulders, bore down on the page of the yearbook too hard. She broke her nail. She began to bleed. She noticed the groove her nail had left in an area of Eddie's shoulder. A pinpoint of blood had spotted the page, but she wet her finger in her mouth and wiped the blood away. Only then did Marion remember that Ted had hired Eddie on the condition that the boy had a driver's license and that Eddie's summer job had been arranged before Ted had told her that he wanted to try separating. The ferry horn blew again. It was so deep a sound that it announced to her what was now the obvious. Ted had known, for some time, that he was leaving her. To Marion's surprise, her awareness of his deceit failed to rouse any anger in her. She could not even be sure if she felt sufficient hatred for him to indicate that she had ever loved him. Had everything stopped or changed for her when Thomas and Timothy died? Until now, she'd assumed that Ted, in his fashion, still loved her. Yet he was the one who was initiating their separation, wasn't he? When she opened her car door and stepped outside to have a closer look at those passengers disembarking the ferry, she was as sad a woman as she'd been at any moment in the past 5 years. Yet her mind was clearer than it had ever been. She would let Ted go. She would even let her daughter go with him. She would leave them both before Ted had a chance to leave her. As Marion walked toward the ferry slip, she was thinking everything but the photographs. For a woman who'd just come to these momentous conclusions, her step was inappropriately steady. To everyone who saw her, she seemed positively serene. The first driver off the ferry was a fool. He was so stunned by the beauty of the woman he saw walking toward him that he turned off the road into the stony sand of the beach. His car would be stuck there for over an hour. But even when he realized his predicament, he couldn't take his eyes off Marion. He couldn't help himself. Marion didn't notice the accident. She just kept walking, slowly. For the rest of his life, Eddie O'Hare would believe in fate. After all, the second he set foot on shore, there was Marion. Eddie is bored, and horny too. Poor Eddie O'Hare. To be in public with his father always caused him complete mortification. the occasion of Eddie's long drive to the ferry docks in New London, or of his seemingly longer wait with his dad for the arrival of the Orient Point ferry, was no exception. Within the Exeter community, Minty O'Hare's habits were as familiar as his breath mints. Eddie had learned to accept that both students and faculty unashamedly fled from his father. The senior O'Hare's ability to bore an audience, any audience, was notorious. In the classroom, Minty's soporific approach to teaching was renowned. The students whom the senior O'Hare had put to sleep were of legendary numbers. Minty's method of boredom was never ornate. Simple repetition was his game. He would read aloud from what he judged to be the significant passages of the previous day's assignment, when, presumably, the material was fresh in the students' minds. The freshness of their minds could be seen to wilt as the class wore on, however, for Minty always located many passages of significance, and he read aloud with great feeling and with repeated pauses for effect. The lengthier pauses were required for sucking on his mints. Little discussion followed the ceaseless repetition of these overly familiar passages, in part because no one could argue against the obvious significance of each passage. One could only question the necessity of reading aloud such passages. Outside the classroom, Minty's method of teaching English was so frequently a matter of discussion that Eddie O'Hare often felt as if he'd suffered through his father's classes, although he never had. Eddie had suffered elsewhere. He was grateful that, since early childhood, he had eaten most of his meals in the school dining hall, first at a faculty table, with another faculty family, and later with his fellow students. Therefore, school vacations were the only times when the O'Hares, as a family, dined at home. Dinner parties, which Dot O'Hare gave regularly, although there were few faculty couples who met with her reluctant approval, were another story. Eddie was not bored by such dinner parties, because his parents restricted his presence at them to the briefest of polite appearances. But at family dinners during school vacations, Eddie was exposed to the stultifying phenomenon of his parents' perfect marriage. They did not bore each other because they never listened to each other. A tender politeness passed between them. The mom would allow the dad to speak at length, and then it was the mom's turn, almost always on an unrelated subject. Mr. and Mrs. O'Hare's conversation was a masterpiece of non sequiturs. By not participating, Eddie could best entertain himself by trying to guess if anything of what his mother or father had said would ever be remembered by the other. Shortly before his departure for the ferry to Orient Point, an evening at home, in Exeter, became a case in point. The school year was over, the commencement exercises recently concluded, and Minty O'Hare was philosophizing on what he called the indolence of the students' behavior in the spring term. "I know that they are thinking of their summer vacations," Minty said, for perhaps the 100th time. "I realize that the return of warm weather is itself an invitation to sloth, but not to slothfulness of such an advanced degree as I observed this spring." His father made these same statements every spring. The statements themselves brought forth a deadening torpor in Eddie, who'd once wondered if his sole athletic interest in running wasn't the result of trying to flee his father's voice, which had the predictable, ceaseless modulations of a circular saw in a lumber yard. When Minty had not quite finished, Eddie's father never seemed to be finished, but he had at least paused for breath or for a bite of food, Eddie's mother would begin. As if it weren't enough that all winter we were witnesses to the fact that Mrs. Havelock chooses not to wear a bra. Dot O'Hare began. "Now that the weather is warm again, we must suffer the consequences of her refusal to shave her armpits, too. And there is still no bra in sight. Now it's no bra and hairy armpits," Eddie's mother declared. Mrs. Havelock was a new and young faculty wife. As such, at least to Eddie and the majority of the boys at Exeter, she was of more interest than most of her counterparts. and Mrs. Havelock's bralessness was, for the boys, a plus. While she was not a pretty woman, but rather plump and plain, the sway of her youthful and ample bosom had fully endeared her to the students, and to those uncounted men on the faculty who would never have confessed their attraction. In those pre-hippie days, in 1958, Mrs. Havelock's bralessness was both unusual and worthy of note. Among themselves, the boys called her Bouncy. For lucky Mr. Havelock, whom the boys deeply envied, they demonstrated unparalleled respect. Eddie, who enjoyed Mrs. Havelock's bouncing breasts as much as anyone, was perturbed by his mother's heartless disapproval. And now, the hairy armpits. These, Eddie had to admit, had been the cause of considerable consternation among the less sophisticated students. In those days there were boys at Exeter who seemed not to know that women could grow hair in their armpits. Or else these boys were deeply distressed to contemplate why any woman would. To Eddie, however, Mrs. Havelock's hairy armpits were further evidence of the woman's boundless capacity to give pleasure. In a sleeveless summer dress, Mrs. Havelock bounced, and she was hairy. Since the warm weather, not a few of the boys, in addition to calling her Bouncy, had taken to calling her Furry. By either name, the very thought of her gave Eddie O'Hare a hard-on. "The next thing you know, she'll stop shaving her legs," said Eddie's mother. The thought of that, admittedly, gave Eddie pause, although he decided to reserve his judgment until he saw for himself if such a growth on Mrs. Havelock's legs might please him. Since Mr. Havelock was a colleague of Minty's in the English department, it was Dot O'Hare's opinion that her husband should speak to him about the disturbing inappropriateness of his wife's bohemianism at an all-boys school. But Minty, although he could bore with the best of bores, knew better than to interfere with the clothing or the shaving or the lack thereof of another man's wife. "My dear Dorothy," was all that Minty would say, "Mrs. Havelock is a European." "I don't know what that's supposed to mean," Eddie's mother commented. But Eddie's father would already have returned, as agreeably as if he had never been interrupted, to the subject of student indolence in the spring. In Eddie's unexpressed opinion, only Mrs. Havelock's mobile breasts and furry armpits could ever relieve the sluggishness he felt, and it wasn't the spring that made Eddie feel indolent. It was his parents' unending and unconnected conversations. They left a veritable wake of slothfulness, a trail of torpor. Sometimes Eddie's fellow students would ask him, "What's your dad's real name, anyway?" They knew the senior O'Hare only as Minty, or, to his face, Mr. O'Hare. "Joe," Eddie would reply, "Joseph E. O'Hare." The E was for Edward, the only name his father called him. "I didn't name you Edward because I wanted to call you Eddie," his father periodically told him. But everyone else, even his mom, called him Eddie. One day, Eddie hoped, just plain Ed would do. At the last family dinner before Eddie left for his first summer job, he had tried to interject some of his own conversation into his parents' unstoppable non sequiturs, but it hadn't worked. "I was at the gym today, and I ran into Mr. Bennett," Eddie said. Mr. Bennett had been Eddie's English teacher in the past school year. Eddie was very fond of him. His course included some of the best books that the boy had ever read. "I suppose we can look forward to seeing her armpits at the beach all summer." "I'm afraid I just may say something," Eddie's mother announced. "I actually played a little squash with Mr. Bennett," Eddie added. "I told him that I'd always been interested in trying it, and he took the time to hit the ball with me for a while. I liked it better than I thought I would." Mr. Bennett, in addition to his duties in the English department, was also the academy squash coach, quite a successful one, too. Hitting a squash ball had been something of a revelation to Eddie O'Hare, who, athletically, had never before tried anything but running. And he wasn't sure that he even liked to run. "I think a shorter Christmas vacation and a longer spring break might be the answer," his father said. I know the school year is a long haul, but there ought to be a way to bring the boys back in the spring with a little more pep in them, a little more get up and go. I've been considering that I might try squash as a sport. I mean, next winter, Eddie announced. I'd still run cross-country in the fall. I could go back to track in the spring. For a moment it seemed that the word spring had caught his father's attention. But it was only the indolence of spring that held Minty in its thrall. Maybe she gets a rash from shaving, Eddie's mom speculated. Mind you, not that I don't get a rash occasionally myself. It's no excuse. Later, Eddie did the dishes while his parents prattled away. Just before going to bed, he heard his mom ask his dad, "What did he say about squash? What about squash?"
"What did who say?" his father asked.
"Eddie," his mom replied. "Eddie said something about squash and Mr. Bennett."
"He coaches squash," Minty told her.
"Joe, I know that."
"My dear Dorothy, what is your question?"
"What did Eddie say about squash?" Dot repeated.
"Well, you tell me," Minty told her.
"Honestly, Joe," Dot said, "I sometimes wonder if you ever listen."
"My dear Dorothy, I'm all ears," the old boar told her. They both had a good laugh over that. They were still laughing as Eddie dragged himself through the requisite motions of going to bed. He was suddenly so tired, so indolent, he guessed, that he couldn't conceive of making the effort to tell his parents what he'd meant. If theirs was a good marriage, and by all counts it seemed to be, Eddie imagined that a bad marriage might have much to recommend it. He was about to test that theory more strenuously than he knew. The door in the floor. En route to New London, a journey that had been tediously overplanned, like Marion, they'd left much too early for the designated ferry, Eddie's father got lost in the vicinity of Providence.
"Is this the pilot's error or the navigator's?" Minty asked cheerfully.
It was both. Eddie's father had been talking so much that he'd not been paying sufficient attention to the road. Eddie, who was the navigator, had been making such an effort to stay awake that he'd neglected to consult the map.
"It's a good thing we left early," his father added.
They stopped at a gas station, where Joe O'Hare made his best attempt to engage in small talk with a member of the working class.
"So how's this for a predicament?" the senior O'Hare said to the gas station attendant, who appeared to Eddie to be a trifle retarded. "Here's a couple of lost Exonians in search of the New London ferry to Orient Point."
Eddie died a little every time he heard his father speak to strangers. Who but an Exonian knew what an Exonian was? As if stricken by a passing coma, the gas station attendant stared at an oily stain on the pavement, a little to the right of Minty's right shoe.
"You're in Rhode Island,"
was all that the unfortunate man was able to say. "Can you tell us the way to New London?" Eddie asked him. When they were back on the road again, Minty regaled Eddie on the subject of the intrinsic sullenness that was so often the result of a subpar secondary school education.
"The dulling of the mind is a terrible thing, Edward," his father instructed him.
They arrived in New London in enough time for Eddie to have taken an earlier ferry.
"But then you'll have to wait in Orient Point all alone," Minty pointed out.
The Coles, after all, were expecting Eddie to be on the later ferry. By the time Eddie realized how much he would have preferred to wait in Orient Point alone, rather than wait in New London with his dad, the earlier ferry had sailed.
"My son's first ocean voyage," Minty said to the woman with the enormous arms who sold Eddie his passenger ticket. "It's not the Queen Elizabeth or the Queen Mary. It's not a 7-day crossing. It's not Southampton, as in England, or Cherbourg, as in France. But, especially when you're 16, a little voyage at sea to Orient Point will do."
The woman smiled tolerantly through her rolls of fat. Even though her smile was slight, one could discern that she was missing a few teeth.
Afterwards, standing at the waterfront, Eddie's father philosophized on the subject of the dietary excesses that were often the result of a subpar secondary school education. In one short trip away from Exeter, they kept running across examples of people who would have been happier or thinner or both if they'd only had the good fortune to attend the academy. Occasionally, Eddie's father would interject at random sprinkles of advice that, out of nowhere, pertained to Eddie's upcoming summer job. "Don't be nervous just because he's famous," the senior O'Hare said, apropos of nothing. "He's not exactly a major literary figure. Just pick up what you can, note his work habits, see if there's a method to his madness, that kind of thing." As the departure of Eddie's designated ferry approached, it was Minty who was suddenly growing anxious about Eddie's job. They loaded the trucks first, and the first in line was a truck full of fresh clams. Or empty, it was on its way to be filled up with fresh clams. It smelled like less than fresh clams in either case, and the clam truck driver, who was smoking a cigarette and leaning against the fly-spattered grill of the clam truck while the ferry docked, was the next victim of Joe O'Hare's impromptu conversation. "My boy here is on his way to his very first job," Minty announced, while Eddie died a little more.
"Oh, yeah?"
the clam truck driver replied. "He's going to be a writer's assistant," proclaimed Eddie's father. "Mind you, we're not exactly sure what that might entail, but it will doubtless be more demanding than sharpening pencils, changing the typewriter ribbon, and looking up those difficult words which not even the writer himself knows how to spell. I look at it as a learning experience, whatever it turns out to be." The clam truck driver, suddenly grateful for the job he had, said,
"Good luck, kid."
At the last minute, just before Eddie boarded the ferry, his father ran to the car and then ran back again. "I almost forgot," he shouted, handing Eddie a fat envelope wrapped with a rubber band and a package the size and softness of a loaf of bread. The package was gift-wrapped, but something had crushed it in the back seat of the car. The present looked abandoned, unwanted. "It's for the little kid. Your mother and I thought of it," Minty said. "What little kid?" Eddie asked. He clutched the present under his chin because his heavy duffel bag and a lighter, smaller suitcase required both his hands. Thus he staggered on board. "The Coles have a little girl. I think she's 4, Minty hollered. There was the rattling of chains, the chug of the boat's engine, the intermittent blasts of the ferry horn. Other people were shouting their goodbyes. "They had a new child to replace the dead ones," Eddie's father yelled. This seemed to get the attention of even the clam truck driver, who had parked his truck on board and now leaned over the rails of the upper deck. "Oh," Eddie said. "Goodbye," he cried. "I love you, Edward," his father bellowed. Then Minty O'Hare began to cry. Eddie had never seen his father cry, but Eddie had not left home before. Probably his mother had cried too, but Eddie hadn't noticed. "Be careful," his father wailed. The passengers who overhung the rails of the upper deck were all staring and listening now. "Watch out for her," his father screamed to him. "Who?" Eddie cried. "Her! I mean Mrs. Cole!" the senior O'Hare shouted. "Why?" Eddie screamed. They were pulling away, the docks falling behind. The ferry horn was deafening. "I hear she never got over it," Minty roared. "She's a zombie!" "Oh, great, now he tells me," Eddie thought. But he just waved. He had no idea that the so-called zombie would be meeting his ferry at Orient Point. He didn't yet know that Mr. Cole was not allowed to drive. It peeved Eddie that his dad had not allowed him to drive the whole way to New London on the grounds that the traffic they would be facing was different from Exeter traffic. Eddie could still see his father on the receding Connecticut shore. Minty had turned away, his head in his hands. He was weeping. What did he mean? A zombie. Eddie had expected Mrs. Cole to be like his own mother, or like the many unmemorable faculty wives who comprised almost everything he knew about women. With any luck, Mrs. Cole might have a little of what Dot O'Hare would call bohemianism in her nature, although Eddie hardly dared to hope for a woman who gave such voyeuristic pleasure as Mrs. Havelock so amply provided. In 1958, Mrs. Havelock's furry pits and swaying breasts were absolutely all that Eddie O'Hare thought about when he thought about women. As for girls his own age, Eddie had been unsuccessful with them. They also terrified him. Since he was a faculty brat, his few dates had been with girls from the town of Exeter, awkward acquaintances from his junior high school days. These town girls were more grown up now, and generally wary of the town boys who attended the academy. Understandably, they were anticipating being condescended to. On Exeter dance weekends, the out-of-town girls struck Eddie as unapproachable. They arrived on trains and in buses, often from other boarding schools or from cities like Boston and New York. They were much better dressed and seemingly more like women than most of the faculty wives, excepting Mrs. Havelock. Before leaving Exeter, Eddie had leafed through the pages of the 53 PM, looking for pictures of Thomas and Timothy Cole. It was their last yearbook. What he found had intimidated him greatly. Those boys had not belonged to a single club, but Thomas was pictured with both the varsity soccer and the varsity hockey teams, and Timothy, lagging not far behind his brother, was captured in the photographs of JV soccer and JV hockey. That they could kick and skate wasn't what had intimidated Eddie. It was the sheer number of snapshots throughout the yearbook in which both boys appeared. In the many candid photos that make up a yearbook, in all those shots of the students who are unquestionably having fun, Thomas and Timothy always appear to be having a ball. They'd been happy, Eddie realized. Wrestling in a pile of boys in a dormitory butt room, the smoker's lounge, clowning on crutches, posing with snow shovels or playing cards, Thomas often with a cigarette dangling from the corner of his handsome mouth. And on the academy dance weekends, the Cole boys were pictured with the prettiest girls. There was a picture of Timothy not dancing with, but actually embracing, his dance partner. There was another of Thomas kissing a girl. They were outdoors on a cold, snowy day, both of them in camel hair overcoats, Thomas pulling the girl to him by the scarf around her neck. Those boys had been popular. And then they had died. The ferry passed what looked like a shipyard. Some naval vessels were in a dry dock, others floated in the water. As the ferry moved away from land, it passed a lighthouse or two. There were fewer sailboats farther out in the sound. The day had been hot and hazy inland, even earlier that morning when Eddie had left Exeter. But on the water, the wind from the northeast was cold, and the sun went in and out of the clouds. On the upper deck, still struggling with his heavy duffel bag and with a lighter, smaller suitcase, not to mention with the already mangled present for the child, Eddie repacked. The gift wrapping would suffer further abuse when Eddie shoved the present to the bottom of the duffel bag, but at least he wouldn't have to carry it under his chin. Also, he needed socks. He'd begun the day in loafers with no socks, but his feet were cold. He found a sweatshirt to wear over his T-shirt, too. Only now, his first day away from the academy, did he realize he was wearing an Exeter T-shirt and an Exeter sweatshirt. Embarrassed at what struck him as such shameless advertising of his revered school, Eddie turned the sweatshirt inside out. Only then did it occur to him why some of the seniors at the academy were in the habit of wearing their Exeter sweatshirts inside out. His new awareness of this height of fashion indicated to Eddie that he was ready to encounter the so-called real world, provided that there really was a world where Exonians were well advised to put their Exeter experiences behind them, or turn them inside out. It was further heartening to Eddie that he was wearing jeans, despite his mother's advice that khakis would be more appropriate. Yet although Ted Cole had written to Minty, telling him that the boy could forget about a coat and tie, Eddie's summer job didn't require what Ted called the Exeter uniform, Eddie's father had insisted that he pack a number of dress shirts and ties and what Minty called an all-purpose sports jacket. It was when he repacked on the upper deck that Eddie first took notice of the fat envelope his father had handed him without explanation, which in itself was odd. His father explained everything. It was an envelope embossed with the Phillips Exeter Academy return address and with O'Hare written in his father's neat hand. Inside the envelope were the names and addresses of every living Exonian in the Hamptons. It was the senior O'Hare's idea of being prepared for any emergency. You could always call on a fellow Exeter man for help. At a glance, Eddie could see that he didn't know any of these people. There were six names with Southampton addresses, most of them from graduating classes in the 30s and 40s. One old fellow who'd graduated with the class of 1919 was doubtless retired and probably too old to remember that he'd ever gone to Exeter. The man was only 57, in fact. There were another three or four Exonians in East Hampton, only a couple in Bridgehampton and Sag Harbor, and one or two others in Amagansett and Watermill and Sagaponack. The Coles lived in Sagaponack, Eddie knew. He was dumbfounded. Did his dad know nothing about him? Eddie would never dream of calling upon these strangers, even if he were in the most dire need. Exonians! He almost cried aloud. Eddie knew many faculty families at Exeter. Most of them, while never taking the qualities of the academy for granted, did not inflate beyond all reason what it meant to be an Exonian. It seemed so unfair that his father could, out of the blue, make him feel that he hated Exeter. In truth, the boy knew he was lucky to be at the school. He doubted that he would have qualified for the academy if he hadn't been a faculty child. And he felt fairly well adjusted among his peers, as well adjusted as any boy who bears an indifference to sports can be at an all-boys school. Indeed, given Eddie's terror of girls his own age, he was not unhappy to be in an all-boys school. For example, he was careful to masturbate on his own towel or on his own washcloth, which he then washed out and hung back in the family bathroom where it belonged. Nor did Eddie ever wrinkle the pages of his mom's mail-order catalogs, where the various models for women's undergarments provided all the visual stimulation his imagination needed. What most appealed to him were the more mature women in girdles. Without the catalogues, he had also happily masturbated in the dark, where the salty taste of Mrs. Havelock's hairy armpits seemed on the tip of his tongue, and where her heaving breasts were the soft and rolling pillows that held his head and rocked him to sleep, where he would often dream of her. Mrs. Havelock doubtless performed this valuable service for countless Exonians who passed through the academy in her prime years. But in what way was Mrs. Cole a zombie? Eddie was watching the clam truck driver consume a hot dog, which the driver washed down with a beer. Although Eddie was hungry, he'd not eaten since breakfast, the slightly sideways drift of the ferry and the smell of the fuel did not incline him towards food or drink. At times the upper deck would shudder and the entire ferry swayed. And there was the added factor of where he was seated, directly downwind of the smokestack. He began to turn a little green. It made him feel better to walk around the deck, and he decidedly perked up when he found a trash can and seized the moment to throw away his father's envelope with the names and addresses of every living Exonian in the Hamptons. Then Eddie did something that made him feel only a little ashamed of himself. He strolled over to where the clam truck driver sat, suffering the agonies of digestion, and boldly apologized for his father. The clam truck driver suppressed a belch.
"Don't sweat it, kid," the man said. "We all got dads." Yes, Eddie replied.
Besides, the clam truck driver philosophized, he's probably just worried about you. It don't sound easy to me, being no writer's assistant. I don't get what it is you're supposed to do.
I don't get it either, Eddie confessed.
You want a beer?
The driver offered, but Eddie politely declined. Now that he was feeling better, he didn't want to turn green again. There were no women or girls worth looking at on the upper deck, Eddie thought. His observation was apparently not shared by the clam truck driver, who proceeded to roam the ferry, looking intently at all the women and girls. There were two girls who had driven a car on board. They were full of themselves, and despite being not more than a year or two older than Eddie, or only Eddie's age, it was evident that they regarded Eddie as too young for them. Eddie looked at them only once. A European couple approached him and asked in heavily accented English if he would take their picture as they stood at the bow. It was their honeymoon, they said. Eddie was happy to do it. Only afterwards did it occur to him that the woman, being a European, might have had unshaven armpits. But she'd been wearing a long-sleeved jacket. Eddie also hadn't been able to tell if she was wearing a bra. He returned to his heavy duffel bag and the smaller suitcase. Only his all-purpose sports jacket and his dress shirts and ties were in the suitcase. It weighed next to nothing. But his mother had told him that his good clothes, as she called them, would be sure to arrive unwrinkled that way. His mom had packed the suitcase. In the duffel was everything else, the clothes he wanted, his writing notebooks, and some books that Mr. Bennett, by far his favorite English teacher, had recommended to him. Eddie had not packed Ted Cole's entire oeuvre. He'd read it. What was the point of carrying it with him? The only exceptions were the O'Hare family's copy of The Mouse Crawling Between the Walls, Eddie's father had insisted that Eddie get Mr. Cole's autograph, and Eddie's personal favorite among Ted's books for children. Like Ruth, Eddie had a personal favorite that was not the famous Mouse Between the Walls. Eddie's favorite was the one called The Door in the Floor. It frankly scared the shit out of him. He hadn't paid close enough attention to the copyright date to realize that The Door in the Floor was the first book Ted Cole had published following the death of his sons. As such, it must have been a difficult book for him to write at all. It certainly reflected a little of the horror that Ted was living in those days. If Ted's publisher hadn't felt such sympathy for Ted because of what had happened to his children, the book might have been rejected. The reviewers were almost unanimously unsympathetic to the book, which sold about as well as Ted's other books anyway. His popularity appeared to be of that unassailable kind. Dot O'Hare herself had said that it would be an act of indecency bordering on child abuse to read that book aloud to any child. But Eddie was thrilled by The Door in the Floor, which, in fact, enjoyed a kind of cult status on college campuses. It was that reprehensible. On the ferry, Eddie thumbed through The Mouse Crawling Between the Walls. He'd read it so many times that he didn't read a word of it again. He looked only at the illustrations, which he liked more than most book reviewers had. Reviewers tended to dismiss Ted Cole's illustrations. At best, they would say the illustrations were enhancing or not obtrusive. More often, the commentary was negative, but not that negative, such as, "The illustrations, while not detracting from the story, add little. They leave one hoping for more next time." Yet Eddie liked them. The imaginary monster was crawling between the walls. There it was, with its no arms and no legs, pulling itself along with its teeth, sliding forward on its fur. Better still was the illustration of the scary dress in Mommy's closet, the dress that was coming alive and trying to climb down off the hanger. It was a dress with one foot, a naked foot, protruding below the hem, and a hand. Just a hand with a wrist wriggled out of one sleeve. Most disturbing of all, the contours of a single breast seemed to swell the dress as if a woman, or only some of her parts, were forming inside the dress. Nowhere in the book
was there a comforting drawing of a real mouse between those walls? The last illustration showed the younger of the boys awake in bed and frightened of the approaching sound. With his small hand, the boy is hitting the wall to make the mouse scurry away. But not only is the mouse not scurrying away, the mouse is disproportionately huge. It is not only bigger than both boys together, it is bigger than the headboard of the bed, bigger than the entire bed and the headboard. As for Eddie's favorite book by Ted Cole, he removed it from his duffel bag and read it once more before the ferry landed. The story of The Door in the Floor would never be a favorite of Ruth's. Her father had not told it to her, and it would be a few years before Ruth was old enough to read it for herself. She would hate it. There was a tasteful but stark illustration of an unborn child inside its mother's womb. There was a little boy who didn't know if he wanted to be born, the book began. His mommy didn't know if she wanted him to be born either. This is because they lived in a cabin in the woods on an island in a lake, and there was no one else around. And in the cabin, there was a door in the floor. The little boy was afraid of what was under the door in the floor, and the mommy was afraid too. Once, long ago, other children had come to visit the cabin for Christmas, but the children had opened the door in the floor and they had disappeared down the hole under the cabin. And all their presents had disappeared, too. Once the mommy had tried to look for the children, but when she opened the door in the floor, she heard such an awful sound that her hair turned completely white, like the hair of a ghost. And she smelled such a terrible smell that her skin became as wrinkled as a raisin. It took a whole year for the mommy's skin to be smooth again and for her hair not to be white. And when she'd opened the door in the floor, the mommy had also seen some horrible things that she never wanted to see again, like a snake that could make itself so small that it could sneak through the crack between the door and the floor, even when the door was closed. And then it could make itself so big again that it could carry the cabin on its back, as if the snake were a giant snail and the cabin were its shell. That illustration had given Eddie O'Hare a nightmare, not when Eddie was a child, but when he was a 16-year-old. The other things under the door and the floor are so horrible that you can only imagine them. There was an indescribable illustration of these horrible things as well. And so the mommy wondered if she wanted to have a little boy in a cabin in the woods, on an island, in a lake, and with no one else around, but especially because of everything that might be under the door in the floor. Then she thought, why not? I'll just tell him not to open the door in the floor. Well, that's easy for a mommy to say, but what about the little boy? He still didn't know if he wanted to be born into a world where there was a door in the floor and no one else around. Yet there were also some beautiful things in the woods and on the island and in the lake. Here there was an illustration of an owl, and of the ducks that swam ashore on the island, and of a pair of loons nuzzling on the still water of the lake. Why not take a chance, the little boy thought. And so he was born, and he was very happy. His mommy was happy again, too, although she told the little boy at least once every day, "Don't you ever, not ever, never, never, never open the door in the floor." And, of course, he never did. And that, thought Eddie O'Hare, is the end of the story. Never realizing that in the real story, the little boy was a little girl. Her name was Ruth, and her mommy wasn't happy. There was another kind of door in the floor that Eddie didn't know about. Not yet. The ferry had come through Plum Gut. Orient Point was now clearly in sight. Eddie took a good look at the jacket photographs of Ted Cole. The author photo on the door in the floor was more recent than the one on the cover of the mouse crawling between the walls. In both, Mr. Cole struck Eddie as a handsome man, suggesting to the 16-year-old that a man of the advanced age of 45, which Ted was, could still move the hearts and minds of the ladies. A man like that would be sure to stand out in any crowd at Orient Point. Eddie didn't know that he should have been looking for Marion. Once the ferry was secured in the slip, Eddie scanned the unimpressive gathering on shore from the vantage of the upper deck. There was no one who matched the elegant jacket photos. "He's forgotten about me," Eddie thought. For some reason, this inspired Eddie to think spiteful thoughts about his father, so much for Exonians. From the upper deck, however, Eddie did see a beautiful woman waving to someone on board. She was so striking that Eddie didn't want to see the man she might be waving to. He assumed that she must have been waving to a man. The woman was so distractingly gorgeous, she made it difficult for Eddie to keep looking for Ted. Eddie's eyes kept coming back to her. She was waving up a storm. From the corner of his eye, Eddie saw someone drive off the ferry into the stony sand of the beach, where the car instantly stalled. Eddie was among the last of the stragglers to disembark, carrying his heavy duffel bag in one hand and the lighter, smaller suitcase in the other. He was shocked to see that the woman of such breathtaking beauty was standing exactly where she'd been when he'd first spotted her, and she was still waving. She was dead ahead of him, and she appeared to be waving at him. He was afraid he was going to bump into her. She was close enough for him to touch her. He could smell her. And she smelled wonderful. When, suddenly, she reached out and took the lighter, smaller suitcase from his hand. "Hello, Eddie," she said. If he died a little whenever his father spoke to strangers, Eddie now knew what it meant to really die. His breath was gone. He couldn't speak. "I thought you'd never see me," the beautiful woman said. From that moment on, he would never stop seeing her, not in his mind's eye, not whenever he closed his eyes and tried to sleep. She would always be there. "Mrs. Cole?" he managed to whisper. "Marion," she said. He couldn't say her name. With his heavy bag, he struggled to follow her to the car. So what if she wore a bra? He had noticed her breasts nonetheless. And in her sleek, long-sleeved sweater, there was no knowing if she shaved her armpits. What did it matter? The coarse hair that had once so thoroughly engaged him with Mrs. Havelock's armpits, not to mention Mrs. Havelock's floppy tits, had receded into the distant past. He felt only a mute embarrassment at the very idea that someone as ordinary as Mrs. Havelock had ever stirred an iota of desire in him. When they arrived at the car, a Mercedes-Benz, the dusty red of a tomato, Marion handed him the keys. "You can drive, can't you?" she asked. Eddie still couldn't speak. "I know, boys your age, you love to drive every chance you get, don't you?" "Yes, ma'am," he replied. "Marion," she repeated. "I was expecting Mr. Cole," he explained. "Ted," Marion said. These weren't Exeter rules. At the Academy, and by extension in his family, because the atmosphere of the Academy was where he had truly grown up, it was Sir and Ma'am to everyone. It had been Mr. and Mrs. everybody. Now it was Ted and Marion. Here was another world. When he sat in the driver's seat, the accelerator and brake and clutch pedals were the perfect distance away from him. He and Marion were the same height. The thrill of this discovery was immediately moderated, however, by his awareness of his immense erection. His hugely evident hard-on brushed the bottom of the steering wheel. And then the clam truck drove slowly past. The driver had noticed Marion, too, of course.
"Nice job if you can get it, kid," the clam truck driver called.
When Eddie turned the key in the ignition, the Mercedes gave a responsive purr. When Eddie stole a look at Marion, he saw that she was evaluating him in a way that was as foreign to him as her car.
"I don't know where we're going," he confessed to her.
"Just drive," Marion told the boy. "I'll give you all the directions you need." A masturbating machine. For the first month of that summer, Ruth and the writer's assistant rarely saw each other. They did not meet in the kitchen of the Coles' house, largely because Eddie ate none of his meals there. And although the 4-year-old and the writer's assistant slept in the same house, their bedtimes were considerably different, their bedrooms far apart. In the morning, Ruth had already eaten her breakfast, either with her mother or her father, before Eddie got up. By the time Eddie was awake, the first of the child's 3 nannies had arrived, and Marion had already driven Ruth and the nanny to the beach. If the weather was unsuitable for the beach, Ruth and her nanny would play in the nursery, or in the virtually unused living room of the big house. That the house was vast made it immediately exotic to Eddie O'Hare. He had first grown up in a small faculty apartment in an Exeter dormitory, later in a not much larger faculty house. But that Ted and Marion had separated, that they never slept in the same house together, was an unfamiliarity of far greater magnitude and cause for speculation for Eddie than the size of Ted and Marion's house. That her parents had separated was a new and mysterious change in Ruth's life as well. The 4-year-old had no less difficulty adjusting to the oddity of it than Eddie had. Regardless of what the separation implied to Ruth and Eddie about the future, the first month of that summer was chiefly confusing. On the nights when Ted stayed in the rental house, Eddie had to go fetch him with the car in the morning. Ted liked to be in his workroom no later than 10 a.m., which gave Eddie time to drive to the Sagoponic General Store and Post Office en route. Eddie picked up the mail and coffee and muffins for them both. On the nights when Marion stayed in the rental house, Eddie still picked up the mail, but he got breakfast only for himself. Ted had eaten earlier with Ruth, and Marion could drive her own car. When he wasn't running errands, which he ran frequently, Eddie spent much of his day working in the empty rental house. This work, which was undemanding, varied from answering Ted's fan mail with indifferent directions from Ted to retyping Ted's handwritten revisions of the extremely short, "A sound like someone trying not to make a sound." At least twice a week, Ted added a sentence or deleted one. He also added and deleted commas. He changed semicolons to dashes and then back to semicolons. In Eddie's opinion, Ted was going through a punctuation crisis. At best, a brand new paragraph would be raggedly created, Ted's typing was terrible, and then instantly and messily revised in pencil. At worst, the same paragraph would be cut entirely by the next evening. Eddie did not open or read Ted's mail, and most of the letters that Eddie retyped for Ted were Ted's replies to children. Ted would write to the mothers himself. Eddie never saw what the mothers wrote to Ted or Ted's responses to them. When Ruth would hear her father's typewriter at night, only at night, what she was hearing, more often than a children's book in progress, was a letter to a young mother. The arrangements that couples make in order to maintain civility in the midst of their journey to divorce are often most elaborate when the professed top priority is to protect a child. Notwithstanding that the 4-year-old Ruth would witness her mother being mounted from behind by a 16-year-old boy, Ruth's parents would never raise their voices in anger to or in hatred of each other. Nor would her mother or her father ever speak truly ill of each other to Ruth. In this aspect of their destroyed marriage,
Ted and Marion were models of decent behavior. Never mind that the arrangements concerning the rental house were as seedy as the unfortunate dwelling itself. Ruth never had to inhabit that house. In the real estate parlance of the Hamptons in 1958, it was a so-called carriage house. In reality, it was an airless, one-bedroom apartment that had been hastily assembled and cheaply furnished over a two-car garage. It was on Bridge Lane in Bridgehampton, not more than 2 miles from the Coles' house on Parsonage Lane in Sagaponack. And, by night, it sufficed as a place for Ted or Marion to sleep far enough away from each other. By day, it was where the writer's assistant worked. The kitchen of the carriage house was never used for cooking. The kitchen table, there was no dining room, was stacked with unanswered mail or letters in progress. It was Eddie's desk by day, and Ted took his turn at that typewriter on the nights he stayed there. The kitchen was supplied with all sorts of booze and with coffee and tea, period. The living room, which was simply an extension of the kitchen, had a TV and a couch where Ted would periodically pass out while watching a baseball game. He never turned on the television unless there was a ball game or a boxing match. Marion, if she couldn't sleep, would watch late-night movies. The bedroom closet contained nothing but an emergency ration of Ted and Marion's clothes. The bedroom was never dark enough. There was an uncurtained skylight which often leaked. Marion, both to keep out the light and to restrain the leak, tacked a towel over the skylight, but when Ted stayed there, he took the towel down. Without the skylight, he might not have known when to get up. There was no clock, and Ted often went to bed without knowing when or where he'd taken off his watch. The same maid who cleaned the Coles' house would stop at the carriage house, too, but only to vacuum it and change the linen. Maybe because the carriage house was within smelling distance of the bridge where the crabbers fished for crabs, usually with raw chicken parts for bait, the one-bedroom apartment had a permanent odor of poultry and brine. And because the landlord used the two-car garage for his cars, Ted and Marion and Eddie would all comment on the permanence with which the odor of motor oil and gasoline lingered in the air. If anything improved the place, albeit slightly, it was the few photographs of Thomas and Timothy that Marion had brought along. She'd taken the photos from Eddie's guest bedroom in the Coles' house and from the adjoining guest bathroom, which was also his. Eddie couldn't have known that the small number of picture hooks left in the bare walls was a harbinger of the greater number of picture hooks that would soon be exposed. Nor could he have predicted the long number of years he would be haunted by the image of the noticeably darker wallpaper where the photographs of the dead boys had been hung and then removed. There were still some photographs of Thomas and Timothy left in Eddie's guest bedroom and bathroom. He looked at them often. There was one with Marion, which he looked at the most. In the photo, which had been taken in the morning sunlight in a hotel room in Paris, Marion is lying in an old-fashioned feather bed. She looks tousled and sleepy and happy. Beside her head on the pillow is a child's bare foot, with only a partial view of the child's leg in pajamas disappearing under the bed covers. Far away, at the other end of the bed, is another bare foot, logically belonging to a second child, not only because of the sizable distance between the bare feet, but because of a different pair of pajamas on this second leg. Eddie could not have known that the hotel room was in Paris. It was in the once-charming Hotel du Quai Voltaire, where the Coles stayed when Ted was promoting the French translation of The Mouse Crawling Between the Walls. Nevertheless, Eddie recognized that there was something foreign, probably European, about the bed and the surrounding furnishings. Eddie also assumed that the bare feet belonged to Thomas and Timothy, and that Ted had taken the photograph. There are Marion's bare shoulders, only the shoulder straps of her slip or camisole are showing, and one of her bare arms. A partial view of its armpit suggested that Marion kept her armpits cleanly shaven.
Marion must have been 12 years younger in the photograph. Still in her 20s, although she looked much the same to Eddie now, only not so happy. Maybe it was the effect of the morning sunlight slanting across the pillows of the bed that made her hair appear more blonde. Like all the other photographs of Thomas and Timothy, it was an 8x10 enlargement that had been expensively matted and framed under glass. By removing the photograph from the wall, Eddie could prop it on the chair beside his bed in such a way that Marion was facing him as he lay on the bed and masturbated. To enhance the illusion that her smile was meant for him, Eddie had only to remove from his mind the children's bare feet. The best way to accomplish this was to remove their bare feet from his sight as well. Two scraps of notepaper, which he affixed to the glass with scotch tape, did the trick. This activity had become his nightly ritual when, one night, Eddie was interrupted. Just as he'd begun to beat off, there was a knock on the bedroom door, which had no lock, and Ted said, "Eddie, are you awake? I saw the light. May we come in?" Eddie, understandably, scrambled. He jumped into a still wet and exceedingly clammy bathing suit that had been drying on the arm of the bedside chair, and he hastily rushed into the bathroom with the photograph, which he crookedly returned to its place on the bathroom wall. "Coming!" he cried. Only as he opened the door did he remember the two scraps of notepaper that were still scotch-taped to the glass, hiding from view the existence of Thomas and Timothy's feet. And he'd left the door to the bathroom open. It was too late to do anything about it. Ted, with Ruth in his arms, was already standing in the doorway of the guest bedroom. "Ruth had a dream," her father said. "Didn't you, Ruthie?"
"Yes," the child said. "It wasn't very nice."
She wanted to be sure that one of the photographs was still here. "I know it isn't one that her mommy took to the other house," Ted explained.
"Oh," said Eddie, who could feel the child staring right through him.
"There's a story to every picture," Ted told Eddie. "Ruth knows all the stories, don't you, Ruthie?"
"Yes," the child said again. "There it is," the 4-year-old cried, pointing to the photograph that hung above the night table near Eddie's rumpled bed.
The bedside chair, which had been pulled close to the bed for Eddie's purposes, was not where it should have been. Ted, holding Ruth, had to step awkwardly around it in order to look more closely at the photograph. In the picture, Timothy, who has skinned his knee, is sitting on the countertop in a large kitchen. Thomas, demonstrating a clinical interest in his brother's injury, is standing beside him, a roll of gauze in one hand, a roll of adhesive tape in the other, playing doctor to Timothy's bloody knee. Maybe Timothy, at the time, was a year older than Ruth. Maybe Thomas was 7.
"His knee is bleeding, but he's going to be all right?" Ruth asked her father.
"He's going to be fine. He just needs a bandage," Ted told the child.
"No stitches? No needle?" Ruth asked.
"No, Ruthie, just a bandage."
"He's just a little broken. But he's not going to die, right?" Ruth asked.
"Right," Ted said.
"Not yet,"
the 4-year-old added.
"That's right, Ruthie. There's just a little blood," Ruth observed.
"Ruth cut herself today," Ted explained to Eddie. He showed Eddie the band-aid on the child's heel. "She stepped on a shell at the beach, and then she had a dream." Ruth, satisfied with the skinned knee story and with that photograph, was now looking over her father's shoulder. Something in the bathroom had caught her attention.
"Where are the feet?" the 4-year-old asked.
"What feet, Ruthie?" Eddie was already moving to block their view of the bathroom.
"What did you did?" Ruth asked Eddie. "What happened to the feet?"
"Ruthie, what are you talking about?" Ted asked. He was drunk, but even drunk, Ted was reasonably steady on his feet. Ruth pointed at Eddie.
"Feet,"
she said crossly.
"Ruthie, don't be rude," Ted told her. "Is pointing rude?" the child asked.
"You know it is," her father replied. "I'm sorry to bother you, Eddie. We have this habit of showing Ruth the photographs when she wants to see them.
but not wanting to intrude upon your privacy, she hasn't seen much of them lately.
You can come see the pictures whenever you want, Eddie said to the child, who kept scowling at him.
They were in the hall outside Eddie's bedroom when Ted said, "Say goodnight, Eddie. Okay, Ruthie?"
"Where are the feet?" the four-year-old repeated to Eddie. She kept staring right through him. "What did you did?"
They went off down the hall with her father saying, "I'm surprised at you, Ruthie. It's not like you to be rude."
"I'm not rude," Ruth said crossly.
"Well..." That was all Eddie heard Ted say. Naturally, after they left, Eddie went straight to the bathroom and removed the scraps of notepaper from the dead boy's feet. With a wet washcloth, he rubbed any trace of the scotch tape off the glass. For the first month of that summer, Eddie O'Hare would be a masturbating machine, but he would never again take Marion's photograph off the bathroom wall. Nor would he again consider concealing Thomas and Timothy's feet. Instead, he masturbated almost every morning in the carriage house, where he thought he would not be interrupted, or caught in the act. On the mornings after Marion had slept there, Eddie was pleased to discover that her scent was still on the pillows of the unmade bed. Other mornings, the feel and smell of some article of her clothing would sufficiently arouse him. In the closet, Marion kept a slip or some sort of nightie that she slept in. There was a drawer with her bras and panties. Eddie kept hoping that she would leave her pink cashmere cardigan in the closet, that one she'd been wearing when he met her. He often dreamed of her in it. But the cheap apartment above the two-car garage had no air conditioning, and the stifling heat of the place was unrelieved by any worthwhile cross-ventilation. While the Coles' house in Sagaponack was usually cool and breezy, even in the warmest weather, the rental house in Bridgehampton was claustrophobic and hot. It was too much for Eddie to hope that Marion would ever have any need of that pink cashmere cardigan there. Notwithstanding the drives to Montauk and back for the evil-smelling squid ink, Eddie's job as a writer's assistant amounted to an easy 9-to-5 day, for which Ted Cole paid him $50 a week. Eddie charged the gas for Ted's car, which was not nearly as much fun to drive as Marion's Mercedes. Ted's 57 Chevy, that model with the memorable fins, was black and white, which perhaps reflected the graphic artist's narrow range of interests. In the evenings, around 5 or 6, Eddie often went to the beach to swim, or else to run, which he did infrequently and half-heartedly. Sometimes the surf casters were fishing for bluefish. They raced their trucks along the beach, chasing after the schools of fish. Driven ashore by the bluefish, minnows were flopping on the wet, hard-packed sand, yet another reason why Eddie had little interest in running there. Every evening, with Ted's permission, Eddie would drive to East Hampton or to Southampton to see a movie, or just to eat a hamburger. He paid for the movies, and for everything he ate, out of the $50 per week that Ted gave him. And he still saved more than $20 every week. One evening, at a movie in Southampton, he saw Marion. She was alone in the audience. Probably because the air conditioning was too cold, she was wearing the pink cashmere cardigan. It was not a night when it was her turn to stay in the carriage house, so it was not likely that the pink cashmere cardigan would end up in the closet of the seedy apartment above the two-car garage. Yet after that sighting of Marion alone, Eddie would look for her car in both Southampton and East Hampton. Although he spotted it once or twice, he never saw Marion in a movie theater again. She went out nearly every evening. She rarely ate with Ruth, and she never cooked for herself. Eddie presumed that if Marion was going out to dinner, she was eating in a better class of restaurant than he usually chose. He also knew that if he started looking for her in the good restaurants, his $50 per week wouldn't last long. As for how Ted spent his nights, it was clear only that he couldn't drive.
He kept a bicycle at the rental house, but Eddie had never seen him ride it. Then one night, when Marion was out, the phone rang in the Coles' house, and the nighttime nanny answered. The caller was the bartender of a bar and restaurant in Bridgehampton, where, the bartender said, Mr. Cole ate and drank almost every night. On this particular night, Mr. Cole had looked atypically unsteady on his bicycle when he left. The bartender was calling to express his hope that Mr. Cole was now safe at home. Eddie drove to Bridgehampton and followed the route he guessed Ted would take to the rental house. Sure enough, there was Ted, pedaling at first in the middle of Ocean Road, and then, as Eddie's headlights illuminated him, veering off the road into the soft shoulder. Eddie stopped the car and asked if he wanted a ride. Ted had less than a half mile to go. I have a ride, Ted told him, waving him on. And one morning, after Ted had slept in the carriage house, there was another woman's smell on the bedroom pillows. It was much stronger than Marion's scent. So, he has another woman, Eddie thought, not yet knowing Ted's pattern with the young mothers. The pretty young mother of the moment came to model 3 mornings a week, at first with her child, a little boy, but then alone. In explanation of his and Marion's separation, all Ted had said to Eddie was that it was unfortunate that his coming to work had to coincide with such a sad time in such a long marriage. Although the statement implied that the so-called sad time might pass, the more the boys saw of the distance that Ted and Marion maintained, the more he believed that the marriage was finished. Besides, Ted had claimed only that it was a long marriage. He hadn't said the marriage was ever good or happy. Yet if only in the many photographs of Thomas and Timothy, Eddie saw that something had been both good and happy, and that the Coles had once had friends. There were pictures of dinner parties with other families, couples with children. Thomas and Timothy had had birthday parties with other children, too. Although Marion and Ted made infrequent appearances in the photographs, Thomas and Timothy, even if only their feet, were the main subject of every photo, there was sufficient evidence that Ted and Marion had once been happy, if not necessarily happy with each other. Even if their marriage had never been good, Ted and Marion had had a multitude of good times with their boys. Eddie O'Hare could not personally remember as many good times as he saw excessively depicted in those photographs. But what had happened to Ted and Marion's friends, Eddie wondered. Excepting the nannies and the models, or model, there was never anyone around. If, as a 4-year-old, Ruth Cole already understood that Thomas and Timothy now inhabited another world, as far as Eddie was concerned, those boys had come from another world as well. They'd been loved.